Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edwin Willett, and this episode's guest, Jean-Louis Trudel. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers. If you are a regular listener, you may note that it's been 3 weeks since the last one, instead of the usual two. I was in Toronto last week and then catching up and all that. And then actually this weekend, I was having some technical difficulties. So it was finally today, Monday, June 6th, that I'm recording this, and hope that you are looking forward to listening to it. My name is Edward Willett. I am your host. I am a author of science fiction and fantasy myself. My next book will be The Tangled Stars. That's coming out in October from Daw Books. So look for that. I'll certainly talk more about it as we go forward. Mainly wanted to mention off the top here, though, the Shadowpaw Press title. Shadowpaw Press is my publishing company that I started in 2018. And I've now kickstarted three anthologies featuring science fiction and fantasy short stories by authors who were guests on this podcast. Shapers of Worlds came out in 2020, and Shapers of Worlds Volume 2 came out in 2021. And what do you know, Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 will be coming out this fall, all published by Shadowpaw Press, all featuring great fiction by great authors, as you might expect. The current one, I think I only have three stories still to come in, one of which is mine, so I should probably write that. And then I will be doing the editing and moving forward for the release sometime this fall. So really looking forward to getting that out there. Shadowpaw Press publishes a lot of other stuff, not just science fiction and fantasy. You can find a lot of my previously published work, which came back to me after other publishers went away. My most recent one, however, was an original tale. Star Song was published by Shadowpaw Press last year. Yes, that was last year. And is available everywhere, and it's currently on the shortlist for the Aurora Award for Best Canadian Young Adult Science Fiction or Fantasy Novel. So please do check that one out. You can find Shadowpaw Press books through any bookstore. You can also order directly from Shadowpaw Press. Shadowpawpress.com is the website. And you can check out everything else that Shadowpaw Press is publishing. There's other science fiction. There's also, middle grade novel in verse currently out, Stay by Catherine Lawrence. On the science fiction side, I have a reprint of Duotero, originally published by Bundoran Press, by author Brad C. Anderson. And coming up, I've got some books by Leslie Godal that I'll be reprinting. I've got some nonfiction coming up. All sorts of stuff. So check out Shadowpaw Press, shadowpawpress.com. And a good chance you'll find a book that you might want to order. You can get them in print or ebook. And they're also available, as I said, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the usual places. Okay, I guess that will do for the introductory material for today's podcast. Let's get on to the guest, Jean-Louis Trudel. Jean-Louis Trudel is the author of 29 books in French for both adults and young adults, as well as a history of science fiction in Quebec, among other works of science fiction criticism. He's also the author of more than 100 short stories in French, published in various magazines, as well as in Canadian, French, and Belgian anthologies. With Yves Maynard, he has collaborated on several stories in French and in English under the pen name Laurent McAllister. In English, he's the author of short stories published in multiple anthologies and magazines, and a few more stories have appeared in English translation. He's also the author of a handful of poems, most recently Summer Encroaching, Winter Yielding, a 2022 Riesling Award nominee. He's also translated into French stories by Canadian author John Park and into English stories by French author Jean-Claude Dugnac, among others. He was the translator from the French of the novel The Dragon's Eye, Tor, by Joël Champetier, and his translations into French of the young adult novels of Monica Hughes' Isis trilogy came out in 2002 and 2003. Jean-Louis Trudel has been an Aurora Award finalist and winner many times since 1992, a Prix Boreal finalist and winner more than once since 1994, and one of the three finalists in 1994, 1995, 1999, and 2001 for the Grand Prix de la Science-Fiction et du Fantastique Québécois. I think that was close, winning in 2001. In 1996, he was among the finalists for Ontario's Trillium Book Award in the French language category. His stories have been translated into English, French, Russian, Greek, Portuguese, Italian, Chinese, and Romanian. He's organized or helped organize science fiction conventions and festivals, including Boreal and the World Science Fiction Convention. His educational background includes a bachelor's degree in physics at the University of Ottawa, a master's degree in astronomy at the University of Toronto, a second master's degree in history and philosophy of science and technology at the University of Toronto, and a doctorate in history from the Université du Québec à Montréal. He has taught in 5 different universities. So, Jean-Louis, welcome to the World Shapers.
Very happy to be on it.
We've known each other a long time, kind of remotely, because as I like to, I often think of Canada like that reference in Aladdin, you know, giant godlike powers, itty bitty living space. In Canada, we have huge country and not a lot of people. So we're all very spread out, but we're connected just by virtue of both being Canadian science fiction writers.
And traveling to conventions from time to time.
Yep, encountering Toronto and Montreal. I've been over there. In fact, I'll be in Montreal this summer as well. So. Only for the second time in my life, I might add.
Wow.
I thought we'd get to go there when we moved up here from Texas in 1967, because at the age of 8, I was convinced that, oh, we're going to Canada, we can go to Expo 67. And my parents had to explain that Saskatchewan was every bit as far away from Montreal as Texas was.
Oh, yes.
Well, anyway, let's begin where I always begin, by taking you back into the mists of time. Tell me about yourself, your background and growing up and all that, and how you got interested specifically in science fiction, probably as a reader, and then in writing this stuff.
Okay, well, yes, it does take me back to the 1970s. I was born in Toronto, but my first memories are in Sudbury, Ontario, and then we moved to Ottawa. And my first science fiction memories go way back, because I remember when my mother was reading to me from a comics magazine in French called Tintin. So this is, or Tintin in English. And this was a magazine that sometimes featured the adventures of Tintin, but also featured lots of other comic strips, all sorts of adventures. And I was struck very young by this adventure that took place in space and the future with weird beings, and it was called Denis Futuro. It was actually a Spanish comic strip which got translated into French for Tintin, and my mother was actually reading the contents of the bubbles to me while I was looking at the picture. So I'm not sure when this was, but obviously I did not know how to read yet. And then later on, I got switched on to science fiction a second time, at least reading-wise, when around grade 3 or 4, when I was in primary school, the librarian had seen me kind of just rampage through the books in French at the library, and I was kind of disdaining the books in English, and she kind of said, well, you know, you're very good in English. You should be able to read a book in English. Pick one. And I picked Space Cadet by Heinlein.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And and you may or may not remember it, but there's actually a bit of French in Space Cadet.
I did not remember that. I remember the book, but it's been a while since I read that one.
Yes, and it also has a fair amount of science, so it spoke to a lot of my interests. After that, I continued rampaging through the library, but this time also looking for science fiction books in English. Though I never read the Tom Swift adventures. They seemed already kind of too juvenile compared to Heinlein.
Yeah, I think I only ever read one of those myself, and I had kind of the same reaction. I was reading Heinlein and Andre Norton and people like that, and I thought, well, this isn't what I'm looking for. So when did you start to think about writing this stuff? Did that also come as a kid?
Oh, yes, definitely. Though My first efforts, which were, I was again quite young and probably around grade 4 or 5, were actually inspired by my readings of the adventures of the pilots of the early 20th century, people like Saint-Exupéry in French. And so my first book, quote unquote, was a something, I don't know, written in one of those Canada booklets, small size, was a trip around the world by one of these pilots, and very fanciful. But a few years later, I started to write, and we're talking longhand with a pencil with illustrations, and I still have a few of those booklets. Basically, the adventures of a group of kids and who meet, who fall, who discover in France a, I think it's some sort of AI left over by aliens, and they eventually develop a secret base outside Ottawa, I think. And there were, I think I actually wrote two or three of these adventures featuring this kind of luminous, light-filled alien AI, or possibly a mind upload, and who had, I think, also a flying saucer at his disposal. So that's how it began. And but by 1984, I was so well. By the time I was 17, so we're almost talking 10 years later, I'd written a lot of things which are archived, safely archived. Developed even a universe or two, I think, and wrote a story that I sent in to the Quebec magazine Imagine, and they were interested. Perhaps I mentioned my age, and they published it. That was the beginning of the kind of professional writing stage, because it was a professional magazine. Within the Quebec context of the time, of course.
Before you got there, when you were still writing the other stuff as a younger writer, were you sharing it with people, letting other people see that you were writing?
I think, oh, that's well, my father knew about it, my parents knew about it. I'm try it's and I think my father accompanied me to some writing workshops, which I might have taken. Again, I'd have to really dig things up around 16, 17. So by the time I was 17 or so, I was really starting to think about becoming a writer. It's the dates are fuzzy at that point, of course. But I think the writing workshop, and my father drove me to a writing workshop in Montreal, I think a 2-day workshop. So both days we drove from Ottawa and came back, and my father went off and did things while I was at the workshop. So I got some good support from my father, who was actually, and there's actually something of a writing tradition in the family. My father, after the war, when he was demobilized, wanted to go into journalism, tried to apply to the Montreal Gazette. Was not reject it was rejected, never, that didn't work out, and wrote a few stories, I think, which he never got published. Later on in the 70s, he took some creative writing classes in Ottawa and published a bit with the Community College magazine. And even if I go back to my grandmother, she I've come across a poem of hers, written kind of around, during the World War I, in honor of the soldiers in World War I. And there's a bit of a literary tradition in the family, but I think I'm the first one to really have published books professionally. Though my grandmother, by the time she was retired, did contribute to a few books of memories about her life as a doctor's wife in Manitoba.
So you were taking some of these workshops and stuff like that. Were there any teachers along the way that were like
Oh,
helpful, and high school
yes.
teachers that inspired you or helped you?
Yeah, I can think of a couple in high school, basically. I don't think, well, even in middle school, I remember that the librarian actually allowed me and a friend of mine to kind of brainstorm on a story in one of the rooms of the library. That was pretty cool. Never actually turned into anything, though he later became more of an artist and drew a an alien that I used in one of what turned out to be one of my first published books years later. But we parted path. That from mine, yeah, no, there are various false starts or often. I remember at one time I'd won a writing contest or placed second, I forget, at the local book fair. And there were writing contests even before 1984, which my father probably encouraged me to submit to. And I forget, I probably placed in the top three or something. So that was encouraging. And at one time when I was placed in this writing contest at the local book fair, there was a small press publisher, a woman called Françoise Marois, who contacted me, kind of was of interested to see what I could write, and I started something, but never, it didn't, it, at the time it didn't turn out, I didn't complete anything, but there was that already that kind of contact with the publishing world, let us say.
So you sold that first short story when you were fairly young. How did things develop from there? You would have been heading into university somewhere along in there. Did you study writing? No. You teach history.
Oh, not at all. When I went to university, I studied physics. Oh. Yes, I got my bachelor's in physics, but you know, within a year, I kind of approached, or maybe even the same the first year, I approached the newspaper, the student newspaper, and throughout university, I ended up writing a lot of for the French and the English language newspapers at the University of Ottawa. And but no, the writing was more on the side. There were some extra credit courses or out of faculty credit courses I had to take. And I took two in history, as I recall, one in sociology, but it was sociology of literary criticism. So for that one, I did get to write an essay about Frankenstein. And I can't remember what the fourth course was. There might have been a French literature course as well, because I remember writing an essay about Maupassant and the Orla, which is a fantastical story, famous one from the 19th century by Guy de Maupassant. So, but no, I didn't, though I think at one point during those years, I also got involved in helping publish a literary magazine, a local literary magazine. We only published one issue before it dissolved, but we did publish at least one. And I seem to recall some contacts with one of the profs at the English department. But for the student newspapers, you know, I was doing a lot of book reviews. In fact, during that time, I also reviewed for the Ottawa Citizen some book reviews for before I finished a bachelor's in physics. And it got, you know, allowed me to meet people, interview people, Paul Auster, and I'm thinking of this Manitoba writer, a woman who wrote this, not the Stone Angel, that would be Margaret Lawrence, but another one. Oh, sorry, the name escapes me. But yeah, no, it was kind of cool meeting a lot. The poet Louis Dudek, I remember him. And I also remember, for some reason, interviewing Charles de Lint at that time. But by that time, I was also attending science fiction conventions and meeting science fiction writers and others directly.
When did you start then trying longer things, novels?
Well,
and when did that first novel come along?
Well, actually, I started with serials.
Hal Dickinson.
Yeah. The guy at the Imagine magazine. After I sent him a couple of stuff, and he published that first story, which was part of my History of the Future, and then a second story, which was a Nazimovian pastiche, and then he proposed that I write a serial, and he was doing all sorts of experiments, and so I agreed. And so between 85 and 87, I published, I contributed every 3 or 4 months an episode in this. And this actually became one of my first books because it was later published as a book in 94. And even after a, so there was a 10-year interval between the first short story and the first book, not 84 to 94, but actually I wrote two serials, actually, one for that Imagine magazine and one for a fanzine in Quebec. And both of them got turned into books for and published in France in 94. And during that time, I was also working on, and that it might even go back before 84, on basically YAs, kids' adventures, because I read a lot of those. And that turned also into two books in 94. So.
What drew you to YA? I mean, in my case, I started writing YA, and I always thought it was because I started writing as a teenager. My characters, I grew up, but my characters never did. It was kind of the way that felt.
Oh, absolutely the same thing for me. I read immense quantities of YAs, and so, and I was already writing those things around, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old with a gang of kids and an alien intelligence upload, whatever. And eventually I kind of got more ambitious in the things I imagined. I wrote quite a bit now that I think about it. But so, as I said, a lot of that is safely archived. But some of these books I imagined between in the early 80s were basically YA adventures with young heroes transported to another planet by some sort. There was actually a kind of stone circle that transported them to another planet, so kind of very outlanderish, but long before Gabaldon came along. And so, yeah, no, it was because I was such a heavy reader of YA, possibly also because there was a YA magazine that I was also reading when I was a kid, and sometimes there was a guest editorial by a guy whom I met later, Daniel Cernin, who was also a publisher of YA books. And I do remember one editorial he wrote about the submission process. So I think it was at the back of my mind for a while, and eventually I published two books. That guy published two of my first YAs, and many others later. So there was this kind of natural transition, one might say, from reading about the process, reading the books, writing all sorts of efforts. And you asked me about, who knew I was reading, and I remember now that some of my younger cousins also read some of my initial efforts, especially some of those early YA books. Yes.
I actually shared the ones I wrote in high school because I wrote three novels in high school, and I typed them up as soon as I learned how to type. That was an important step, was learning how to type, and passed them around to my classmates. So I got some immediate feedback on, and generally that was, it was positive. I found out that I could tell stories that people liked to read, even though the girls made fun of my love scenes. But I was 16, so I guess that was to be expected.
Yeah, well, there were not too many love scenes in my early fiction.
Not in mine either. So, oh, sorry.
I think I've lost what I was going to say, so go ahead.
I was just going to say you went on. You were writing hot and heavy there for many years. Looking at your bibliography, it seems like you had three or four books coming out year after year after year.
Yeah, there was a period, somewhat paradoxically, that coincides roughly with my PhD. The second, well, I should say the, I almost said the second one, because I start, I after physics, I did astronomy, started a PhD in astronomy. That didn't work out, so I did another master's, this time in history and philosophy of science and tech. And one of the things that turning point in my career, writing career, was basically when I decided to take a year off after the second master's and before starting a PhD in Montreal. I decided to spend that year on writing. That's the year when I turned, those four early books, two for adults, two for kids, into publications. Yes, I, and at the time that meant that I actually kind of retyped from basically for at least for the first one, the one that appeared in 85, 87, I retyped because OCR was still kind of primitive back then, let us say. And so, but the second one I actually had some computer files and was much easier. So a full year during which I wrote short stories, but also yeah, started writing these, started getting these books out, and that was the beginning of at least an active YA writer career, as well. And during the PhD, the YAs were manageable because I could write them rather quickly. I think my record was writing one of these in 3 weeks, but usually it did take a bit longer. But the with the PhD, I was able to kind of manage my time and maybe write in the evening at night and do some of the rest of the work in the daytime. And at some point, as I sometimes said, the PhD kind of subsidized my writing. And then towards the end of the PhD, my writing subsidized the PhD. I was the writing part, also school visits, translations, but also, yeah, part of the royalties. And then when I finished a PhD and started teaching, well, there's actually a big drop off in my book production. And though I've continued to write short stories, it's
You teach at the University of Ottawa, correct?
yes, that's the main teaching gig. I've also taught in at least I think three or four other universities. Currently, I also teach in Laval in Quebec City, but most of the teaching is in Ottawa.
Do you find that having, well, you had physics, you had astronomy, those are good things for science fiction writers. And then the history, has that all fed into your writing, your academic training and knowledge, does that feed into your writing?
Absolutely. I remember having, ideas for stories while in physics class, hearing about, say, neutron stars and starting to have ideas about how I could have neutron stars collide and how they could be actually moved to collide. And the history research made me discover all sorts of quirky eras. And in more recent years, I have turned some of those discoveries of intriguing, let's say, side notes, historical side notes into stories. There was a series in France of anthologies where the theme was, the theme was different eras in history, and I think I contributed to almost every one of these, and in several cases, it drew upon what I'd research or found out during the PhD or in ancillary research. So yes, the it's you know it's been now it's almost 30 years since I left astronomy and physics. I've been recently recycling some old course notes, class notes, and the mathematics is now beyond me. I could probably reconstruct that, but it would probably take me as almost as long to understand the mathematics and the formalisms again as it took me initially. But I knew that once. But the kind of the basic knowledge of astronomy and such is still with me, and there are still some ongoing projects where sometimes started long ago, but which where I am going to try and use some interesting things I noted about particular stars. And so these are, yeah, these are, there are ongoing projects using all strands.
You write primarily in French. You have written some in English. What's the difference from a writer's point of view between the two languages? What are the, is one language better at some things than the other? I'm fascinated by that because I'm rather aggressively unilingual, except for, 2 years of high school French or whatever I had.
Well, yeah, I know that's always a very interesting question. And Michel Laframboise, who's started much more recently writing in both languages, has noted a few things that have also to do with the expectations of the markets. In France, the publishers are often looking for a more literary approach. And in North America, especially in the commercial, on the commercial side of the field, you're looking for kind of much more stripped down stories. And English does lend itself very well to, it's almost a certain form of, I wanted to say poetry, but there's something very, it lends itself very well to kind of putting as few words as possible on the page and letting the reader construct a story around that. Some of that was done in French in the early 20th century in popular fiction, but my take on a lot of what is being published in French science fiction nowadays is that there is much more attention to language, to writing something that the reader is going to be able to, where the reader is going to be able to savor every word up to a point and almost every sentence. So after, and you know, it's there are of course shades and degrees between the two, but you know that probably describes relatively well the polarity between the two, because of course you know you also get there's also a literary brand of writing in English, which is, you know, which you will get exposed to in creative writing classes at the university level, and which I see, you know, when you go and read Don DeLillo, let us say, it's an interestingly different kind of writing from, let us say, genre fiction. And it's interesting to think about the differences between the two, certainly.
Well, let's talk about your creative process. And one part of the creative process in this case is that the book we're going to talk about is one that was a collaboration with Yves Maynard. So the two of you write together as Laurent McAllister. How did that come about?
I think the collaboration itself goes back years, because we met initially at a science fiction convention in Longueuil, Quebec, back in 86. And we crossed paths from time to time. And then he showed up in Ottawa in 89, when I was still in Ottawa, for, I think he had a summer job of a few months. And we decided that we might as well try and collaborate, because every conversation we had was stimulating. We bounced off ideas, readings, and we were part. And while we were in Ottawa, we were also part of a writing group, an English language writing group, with people like Andrea Schlecht, Hildegard Henderson, Sanssouci Walker. John Park was part of that group, and so we got to see, you know, what we were writing, and we decided to start writing together in '89. There was an initial short story, then another short story, and at some point, we wanted to make it a bit of a game and challenge. We decided that we would never write the same thing twice. So our first story together was a straight science fiction set in my fictional universes. The second one was kind of very experimental, a bit Dickian. There was a historical pastiche, or historical hoax, in fact, that we wrote, and so on. There was a story in the style of Serge Brussolo, a French writer, and then we decided to do a big, fat space opera. And that was probably in the early 90s, and we started to brainstorm. I know that by roughly 96, we had several chapters done, which we showed to colleagues in France. And some of them, I think there was quite a divergent opinion. One of the colleagues we showed it to, a good friend of ours, liked it a lot. Another one said, this should be completely reordered, because it doesn't seize the reader early enough. And after that, there was a fallow period until 2008, when basically, as part of the run-up to the Worldcon in Montreal, a publisher in France decided that he wanted to publish this story. It was actually this one of the colleagues we'd shown this to, and so he gave us a contract, gave us a timeline. It had to be out in time for the Worldcon, and so we brainstormed again and got to work.
And that's the big fat space opera, as you called it. Supremacy, is that the pronunciation?
Suprématie.
Supremacy. And it does look long. I mean, I'm looking at the Amazon listing here. 672 pages, it says in
And
paperback.
rather dense font. I think it was a million and a half characters. Characters? Signs? Well, anyways, probably translates into something like 300,000 words or so.
And how about a synopsis of it before we start talking about it?
Okay, so this is a story of revenge. You have this civilization that called the Supremacy that believes in, one might say, reducing conflict by basically assimilating everybody. This is not quite the Boer because while there are some implants, the idea is more about cre not creating a collective consciousness or a single collective consciousness, but creating instead a consensus worldview. And so there are implants to kind of keep people on the straight and narrow, but everybody is still an individual. And so this was kind of also an observation about the social consensus in our societies. So this is a kind of a bit like the Boer, an ever encroaching, powerful civilization that wherever it comes will try and as convince people to be part of their consensus. And so our hero, Alcaino, was formerly a kind of, I think, spaceship commander for the Supremacy, but he kind of turns against them when he's a witness to atrocities that basically kind of break his conditioning. And he eventually becomes this kind of space pirate. And I forget, and eventually, does his own space pirate stuff for a while within this open cluster NGC 457. I actually wrote a short scientific paper on the open cluster of stars where this actually happens. But eventually the encroachments, the invasions, the annexations of the supremacy become too great to tolerate. He's called upon to intervene with his pirate ship, very powerful pirate ship with an AI. There's probably some influence of Captain Harlock on the anime side in terms of this character. Because Captain Harlock in French is known as Albatar. So Alcaino, Albatar, we probably had that somewhere at the back of our minds. And so eventually he goes on this crusade against the supremacy until he decides that the only way to kind of break their hold on the open cluster is to destroy his own home planet. And so I'll leave it at that and
Do you remember? I mean, this was a long gestation period before this
indeed.
thing. Do you remember the very initial seed of the idea and how that where it came from?
That's a good question.
And on a larger scale, what are the typical seeds for your stories?
I wonder to, yeah, I know that we wrote the epilogue years ahead. The epilogue was written before something like probably 90% of the book was written, if not 199% of the book. So we kind of had this arc. We knew the guy was going to destroy his home planet, and we use a time paradox, a time loop, and for that, it's a kind of time loop that you see in There was a recent Doctor Who episode with Capaldi locked in this prison where he time loops in order to destroy a diamond wall. I don't know if that speaks to you.
Yes, I remember that one.
Yeah,
okay.
And I remember it well because, you know, I thought, well, we should claim royalties. But again, there was this long gestation period, which meant that a lot of the things that we imagined back in the 90s that were kind of fresh and new were kind of, you know, done by other people. Some of Linda Nagata's work in Vast, for instance, I also felt, ah, oh, God. So the seed there, I must say, I can't quite remember it. The arc was clear to us very early on, but I cannot remember if that was the seed or if there was something else. I think we did start, probably, brainstorming, might have been at a convention in Ottawa, over the idea of, yes, this time we're going to do a big fat space opera, so what is it going to be about? So we had the genre before we had, I think, the plot and the idea. And then we probably had kind of the, I think we also wrote the prologue and the epilogue kind of very early on, and then it was a matter of planning part of the initial section. And then in 2008, when we brainstormed again, we plotted the last half of the book. So in terms of seeds, they can come from all sorts of places. One of my early YAs, I think, came out of just going to sleep on the bus going home, being awakened, and at this point I suddenly started imagining this young character awakened when his ship come in, actually a boat, a seagoing ship, comes into port in a small village and nobody's waiting for him, whereas he was expecting his parents to be there. And I wrote the story from that seed.
So kind of an image in that case.
Yeah, feeling an image, a situation. Going even further back to one of those my earliest novel has this, the actual seed was a short story. I remember now how that serial came about. I wrote a short story for Imagine, and it was after writing the short story and submitting the short story that the guy came back to me and said, this could be the beginning of a novel, and turned into a serial. The story itself, was about a character who's, this was inspired a bit by this, the corpsicles of Larry Niven, the people, you know, going into cryonic suspension and imagining what it would be to wake up in the 21st century. My twist for that story, I was 17, was that because I was science oriented. So my twist there was, given the fact that science says that the brain should be just mush after the freezing and thawing process, but let us imagine that it's, while the memories may have been erased, some future doctor decides to impose memories on this guy, and actually it tries to pass him off, because he's going to have the memories of it, as a survivor of Atlantis. So but the guy actually kind of has enough leftover memories to figure out that it's untrue, and that was a short story, and then it turns into a serial. I forget what was the actual seed for that, but that was the kind of the beginning. I went back to some, going back, you see some of the influences. I mentioned Larry Niven, and there were also some French comic strips that once I looked at that novel again, I could see the influences. Let's see, if I look at more recent stuff, a book, I decided to write a book to do something better. I think the last batch of YAs, perhaps even the last two, they were written because I had just seen Star Wars 1, the, you know, the not the Star Wars 4 back in the 70s, but
yeah, the Phantom Menace.
The Phantom Menace. And I was so kind of, I don't know if disgust is the right word, but I decided to rewrite this as something better. And it did start with a kind of a princess who's got to save her planet from invaders, but if completely different touch, and no Anakin.
Yes, he was a bit of a problem. Well, once you have an idea, and going back again to the novel, you talked about how you plotted it out. What does that look like for you? Is it a very detailed outline? Is it more just notes that you then build on, or how does that look?
I've never been one for outlines. And sometimes when I've tried to even outline short stories and then start writing, it diverges. I think the first half of Supremacy, we probably discussed things, even me, enough to know what we wanted to do in these first chapters, and then we went ahead and wrote. Back in the 90s, I don't quite remember how we did that, but in 2008, when we decided to finish the book, we met at a cottage, we sat down, we brainstormed, we plotted. The outline, I don't know, to me, I think, no, it was not as detailed an outline as some of the outlines I've seen. It was more about the logic of the events, how one scene or chapter or incident would lead to another. And then we assigned ourselves alternate chapters. So I'd write one chapter, he'd write the next chapter. And eventually we'd read what had been written and adjust so that it was all consistent. We also started a YA fantasy series as the Han McAllister, and I think there was some plotting there. But again, probably relatively cursory. I remember meeting at Eve's place and brainstorming about what this volume of the YA series would be about and where it would start, where it would finish. And then we assigned each other parts that we would write entirely and then kind of pass the baton to the other person.
Where did Laurent McAllister come from as a pseudonym?
That actually comes from a short story by Eve. Eve wrote this short story about a kind of a post-apocalyptic world where the people, I think, receive books on their doorstep. This is a bit vague, and these are books that tell them stories, and I think some of the characters might be a bit adrift and sometimes may identify the story as being their own, but the manuscripts or the books are delivered without a title. And so this first story was a short story without a title, and actually Eve tried to convince the publisher of Solaris that it should appear as a blank, really, literally, a story without a title. But the publisher said, well, this is going to really mix people up. Let's just call it Without a Title as the title of the story. And the main character was called Laurent McAllister. And it seemed kind of interesting that, these characters, I think, were claiming these books or manuscripts that were showing up as their own. And so Laurent McAllister as a symbionym seemed like a logical solution, because this fictional character would be claiming the books we wrote.
Now, I haven't heard that expression before, a symbionym, but that makes sense. It's the name for two people.
Exactly. We may have come up with it. I don't know. I've had to Google it.
Well, it makes perfect sense. So once you have a manuscript, you sort of talked about how you wrote, throwing things back and forth, but Then what does the revision process look like with both for your regular stuff you write yourself and for the collaboration?
One thing that we might want to talk about or not at some point is, you know, there's the writing process and there's the world building process. And that is something that I, as a writer, I've always been very, it can become a kind of a black hole. I can certainly. Yes.
Well, talk about that then. Okay. Tell me about the world building process.
Yeah. Well, in the case of Supremacy, as I mentioned, I actually even wrote a short kind of scientific paper about this open cluster, which is around one of the stars in the constellation of Cassiopeia, and that's where it actually takes place. And so that was part, and for me, the world building process is part of kind of creating a reality. For Supremacy, I think it was mostly me doing the world building, but at various points, there was this short scientific paper. I actually went into calculations because the time loop involved actually faster than light particles, and this goes back to what Benford did in Timescape, and there are possibilities in terms of faster than light particles traveling back in time, and I actually looked up some papers. I also looked up some papers on strange quark matter, I think it was, because that was part of the gimmick of the super weapon that Alcaino developed. There were also Excel spreadsheets which I set up to.
There's always Excel spreadsheets
to keep track of the characters. And especially since this was, you know, a big spaceship, lots of positions. I think I actually even came up with the organizational structure of the spaceship. Now, there was one presentation I did afterwards. The book won an award or two. We were able to do a presentation where I showed that, you know, once the structure was there, lots of the pages were actually blank. I did not bother coming up with, say, 600 names. The structure was set up, and then we filled a few names, knowing where they were in the hierarchy, but not going beyond that. But and I even as part of Supremacy, started to use Google SketchUp to create 3D versions of the spaceship and a few other of the interesting locales. There was a kind of a ring city. There was a ring structure around one of the planets, which was actually used to kind of cool down the planet. So it was irradiating, but there were kind of anchor points of that ring, which were cities themselves. So there was a whole lot of world building that came also, you know, is part to me of a writing process in science fiction. I've been doing that for years, in fact, drawing maps in some cases, or in this case, it was more Excel, 3D modeling, and looking into scientific papers. So that is something that we've almost run out of time, but we can talk about if you want. As for the revision process, pretty good about, you know, respecting what the other does and making corrections that are improvements. The revision process for Supremacy was actually kind of rushed because we were crowding that deadline for a publication at the Worldcon. So it was a time when I discovered track changes in Word, because until then I'd been working with other types of software. And actually, a lot of the earlier manuscripts, the YAs, of course, the revision was still in part revising on paper and then uploading the corrections to the file. So working with track changes in Word in 2008, 2009 was a bit, well, new. And there were things about it that drove me crazy. But I don't remember what it was, and since then, used it quite a lot.
Yeah, I use it all the time, and it does actually still drive me crazy a little bit sometimes. But it's what we've got. What was the editorial process like then? This was a fairly rushed book. What kind of feedback did you get once it hit the editor?
Trying to remember. Well, no.
And what's kind of typical for you with editorial revisions?
Well, in the case of Supremacy, the deadline was tight, so the editor offered a number of suggestions, but they did not really affect the structure of the book. He went with the structure as it was. Possibly if we'd had another year, he might have proposed what this other guy had proposed back in the 90s, that we inverse some of the structure. But we went with a relatively linear structure the prologue is kind of a flash forward to the ending, but apart from that, it's kind of linear from beginning to end with, well, possibly a few flashbacks, but really rather linear. So I'm a relatively relaxed guy about editorial changes. I've known writers who were exasperated by them, but you know, if as long as it makes sense, and I've got a fairly Catholic view of what makes sense in terms of writing, I'll usually follow the editor's directions. There were perhaps, when I was working on the YAs, more ambitious changes that were proposed, and I forget it was rarely cases of, you know, trashing three chapters or something like that. It was usually more fine tuning. After all, the writing was usually, after all, relatively straightforward. Sometimes, you know, you get more pushback from the editors when you're trying something more ambitious or a bit more different in terms of structure or in terms of voice choices and so on. When it's relatively linear and it kind of works that way, I get the impression editors are will not necessarily push back that much, or will push back a bit less.
In my case, it's usually just my books tend to get longer in the editorial process, because I'll be asked to, you know, develop the why characters did something a little bit more. It was clear in my head, but I didn't get it on the page, is what that boils down to. Well, because we are getting close to the end here, let's move on to my big philosophical questions, which I warned you about. Why do you write? Why would anybody write? Why does anybody write? And why stories of the fantastic specifically?
Well, these days, I continue writing, and it's up to a point, it probably saves my sanity.
I hear that a lot, actually, from authors.
Okay. But there is, even though I'm only writing short stories, but a fair amount, and I'm still kind of working on various novel projects off and off, especially the last couple of years with the pandemic, which translated for me in a kind of just a very heavy load of work, heavier than even before. Taking sometimes half an hour or an hour per day to write, sometimes at the cafe, there are two things about the writing process. First of all, there's the necessary kind of relaxation. You've got to open yourself up to ideas, to immerse yourself into the universe of a story. And that is, there are people who pay to meditate, and this is actually, a free exercise to really kind of completely divorce yourself from the emergencies of the day, from all the cares and worries of your daily grind. And then when you've done that and you start to imagine things, start to write a story, I think there is something very satisfying in constructing a plot, imagining the characters who are going to fit in that plot, and starting to write and make these things real. And, the day, In my daily work is there are different satisfactions in teaching or in putting together teaching materials, but things like marking can be quite a grind, and so there's something very satisfying in being the entire master of the world of the story I create, and it is that I think that's creative urge that or that cream well, that creative pleasure that is very much part of the satisfaction of writing.
Why do human beings as a whole tell made up stories
Well,
and write them down?
that is a slightly different thing. I think that's the urge to communicate, to reach out to people, and I'm always happy when a story is taken up, but I think that as a writer, if you up to a point, if you the when I write, I want to be, let us say, understood. I want to bring some sort of pleasure to the reader. But I think that if you spend too much time worrying about communicating with your readers, at some point, some of the pleasure of the pure creative pleasure, and there's also a kind of problem-solving pleasure as well when you're writing because, you've put your character in an impossible situation, or how are you going to solve that? So there's problem solving, there's creative, there's the mastery over the universe that you're creating, and I think that as a writer, if too much depends on being read, I think it probably can cramp your style up to a point. You've got to, I think it, I find it freeing anyway, not to be too concerned about whether this is going to sell a million copies. As long as publishers accept my stories, editors buy my stories, that is enough for me to say, to kind of confirm that I've communicated that story to at least one person, and after that it's going to be out in the wild, out in that wide world, and it's up to the world to do with it what it wants.
Why stories of the fantastics and not stories about the everyday world?
Well, there are probably various ways to analyze that. There's kind of this dimension, you could call it the slan dimension, going back to Van Vogt. The idea that a lot of science fiction fans have been, at least in the past, and I think probably still today a bit, people who don't feel like they fit entirely in everyday society in the present day world, and find in these stories of the fantastic worlds where they feel they could perhaps fit better. And I was a Franco-Ontarian growing up in Ontario, so speaking a minority language. My mother is a French immigrant, so I was I we were and we were going back to France regularly. And my great, I had an aunt, or I think great aunt, who and I had a part of the family was in the U.S. So and some of them we came to Canada to visit. So I had this kind of experience as a kid of being part of several worlds, but not being part of the majority world in Ontario. So I think probably some of the my affection for science fiction and fantastic comes from that, and I think other people have different experiences of marginality, or at least being on the edges, and it may, and I think some of them do find science fiction and the fantastic congenial
Yeah,
for that.
it's like being a kid from Texas talks like this, comes up to Saskatchewan when you're 8 years old.
Aha.
That can kind of make you feel a little out of place too.
Yes, you're a literal alien.
I was.
And yeah, I think that's a from you know when I when we speak to colleagues, it seems to be a relatively common experience. I will add to that that because I've had this scientific grounding over time, and I've written, I've some of the YAs I wrote were straight mysteries. I've written some fantasy. I've written some fantastic. In more recent times, I've also written a few mainstream stories, not many, but a few. But I keep coming back to science fiction, and I think one of the urges nowadays is that I feel it's a greater challenge. That may be very kind of self-serving as an appreciation, but I do feel that writing at least an original a science fiction story drawing upon ideas that have not been seen before, or at least that you're trying to bring a new twist to, and using and trying to be faithful, accurate with respect to the science, that's a hell of a challenge. And I think there is something in my makeup that sometimes pushes me to tackle the more difficult things rather than the easiest things. And so science fiction, sometimes I feel like, I could write a fantasy YA, just sit down and write one. Whereas science fiction forces me to sit down and think before I write. And so there is that element to it, I think.
I just was thinking of a JFK speech. We choose to go to the moon, and not because it is easy, but because it is hard, or to that effect.
Indeed, indeed.
Well, as we wrap up here, what are you working on now?
Well, just looking at the pieces of paper around me, there is this no big novel, kind of space opera, and it involves one of these not a I guess it's not really a narc generation ship or a narc ship in a sense that it was originally, but it's been transformed into a it was initially transformed into a kind of a traveling convention center. That's actually the backstory. And then the crew took over, and the crew and the staff took over and decided to make it just their traveling home in this crumbling space empire. And they also decided to try and make themselves immortal. And this immortality is of the type that C.J. Cherry explored in Cytene. I don't know if you remember that one, but
I remember reading it.
yeah. And but the idea is about kind of learning to be your genetic predecessor through various forms of recovering, exploring memories, and so on. So it's not immortality through anything that is very pseudo-scientific or requires a lot of far-flung science. It's about learning to be another person, and it can get into some interesting philosophy, the ship of Theseus problem, or these Japanese temples that are built and rebuilt, but because you keep the same design, the Japanese consider that it's the same temple even 5 or 10 centuries later. And so what if you do that with people? And it's of course one way of seeing it. And I'm interested in writing about the kids going through the process, or at least some of the new jet kids going through the process, is that it's about allowing yourself to be possessed by the personality that they're clones, however, so there is that kind of basis. But yeah, and that time and there's a fair amount of other things in that book, so it's a big project with lots of ideas
Sounds
with
like it.
lots of ideas. So it's been keeping me busy for a few years now. And I'd like to, yeah. And I've got a few short stories on the run, on the go, I should say. So I probably half a dozen at the same time. And right now I'm thinking of going back to writing in English because last few weeks have been more, or months have been mostly in French. And now it's my university courses are over, and I'm thinking of going back and doing some stuff in English.
And where can people keep up with you online?
Well, there's a Facebook author page, which you can probably find very easily by just looking up Jean-Louis Trudel. And I have a blog, which is rather quiescent, if not dormant, called Culture du Futur.
It's not dead, it's just sleeping.
Yes, dormant, hibernating. But I've ha added things from time to time. I've launched a Substack thing, but I was too busy over basically since the beginning of the university term in September to add to it. And it's called, I think, The View from Altair, the star Altair. I'm not sure how you pronounce it in English. And of course, it's an Arabic name.
Altair.
Okay. So The View from Altair. And but that one I do want to get back to, if only because there is a possibility of making money with it eventually.
I went to school in Arkansas. Our yearbook at Harding University was named after a mountain, which is a Petitjean. Petit Jean.
Ah, yes.
And of course, it was pronounced Petty Jane. So. Well, thanks, Jean-Louis, for being on The World Shapers. I really enjoyed the chat. I hope you did,
absolutely,
too. Absolutely. And I'm sure we'll run into each other in person again one of these days.
I certainly hope so. So keep well and take care.
And thanks again to Jean-Louis for that great conversation. I really enjoyed that, and I hope you did as well. That brings us to the end of this episode of The World Shapers. Just the usual things to tell you, namely that The World Shapers can be found online at theworldshapers.com. It's also on Twitter at The World Shapers and on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me personally online at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. And you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. I don't see any easy way to unify all of those handles at this late date. You can find Shadowpaw Press, which, as I've mentioned, has published two anthologies, with the third to come, featuring authors who were guests on the podcast. It's at shadowpawpress.com. You can find it on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press. You can find it on Instagram at Shadowpaw Press, and you can find it on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press. That one, at least, I got them all the same. Oh, and I should mention also, you can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/EdwardWillett. I like to mention that one because one of the things I do is I walk around Regina, here where I live, Regina, Saskatchewan, about an hour, not quite every day, but almost, you know, at least 5-6 times a week. And I talk as I walk, so it's kind of a vlog, you know. And sometimes I talk about things that I'm working on in the science fiction side of things, and mostly I just talk and occasionally sing. So if you want to check that out, that's at youtube.com/EdwardWillett. And that, I think, really is the end of this podcast. So thanks so much for checking in and having a listen, and I hope that you'll come back many times over in the future as I continue to talk to the science fiction and fantasy authors who have created the wonderful worlds and stories and characters that we have enjoyed down through the years and will continue to enjoy in the years to come. That's it for this time. Bye for now.